You don't seem to have any questions, Norman. You're going to tell me what?
Oh, no, that's not bad.
Ask
you
one, James.
Yeah?
Reading a book by someone who has recovered from schizophrenia. You mentioned this business, that there's a certain stage in schizophrenia where they appear to become psychic and begin to be able to read the minds of the psychiatrist, sometimes to the discomfiture of the psychiatrist.
Mm.
I wonder if those people get through the centre when they're in that state.
Let's have a look at the mechanics of it. We've got a very short, simple diagram of the human psyche, and we have a circle to represent the limiting factor of the individual. We know that this limiting factor is merely a rotation of force within a field, and therefore the limit is merely a functional one determined by certain frequencies. There is no actual separation between the paper underlying the diagram and the paper beyond the diagram. So there is factually a field of absolute consciousness internal to which these individuated beings appear. If there were only one being, we wouldn't have a problem at all. But because there are beings plural, therefore contingent stimulation can arise. And if your sense organs are stimulated, then you record inside each sense organ what that organ has actually experienced. So you get a five-fold record of experiences, and you also get a record of the coordination of these five sense stimuli complexes. And then inside you have your intellect, which can analyze the matter logically and is superior to the common sense, which is simply the pentagon form symbolizing that which is common to the five senses. Now, if you stimulate any being simultaneously from two sides, and the stimulus level, the energy input, is very great and of a different frequency, you can cause the tissue here to rupture. In the case of an amoeba, which is generally adapting its shape all the time to the external stimulus situation, it puts out a pseudopod, a false foot, towards the food particle and then flows round the food particle. We say this is a positive toxic reaction. It also flows away from painful stimuli. And if we give it two pleasant stimuli on opposite sides simultaneously, it tends to become attenuated. And if we surround it with painful stimuli, it tends to contract into the form of a sphere. Now, in the same way, if we stimulate the protoplasm of our being from many different angles, with various characterized stimuli, A, B, C, and so on, and we overstimulate it so that it cannot assimilate them all, it begins to be ruptured by the incoming stimuli. And if these stimuli are of totally different characters, so that they cannot integrate together, the result is that the being tends to split into separate zones, each zone characterized by the stimulus energy dominating in that zone. Now, if we carry this to its term, we can say we are splitting the being into separate entities, and these separate entities are the many minds or multiple personalities that we find in certain mental disorders. We can only get this multiplicity providing we feed the data in a haphazard, unintegrated manner and at various strengths so that they cannot be assimilated together. Luckily for us, we have a nucleus which in fact is impregnable to an external stimulus. This is our essential being, our inner self. in the case of a man who becomes split into many parts, the field of this man may eventually come to be more important to the content of consciousness than any given complex of ideas. Make it as simple as possible. Here is a being. I draw a circle. Imagine we kept this being into three beings by subjecting it to three orders of stimuli which are not capable of integration. The being tends to rupture into three beings. Now, if the rupturing process goes on quite a lot, the gap between these personalities widens, and the being then has a zone created inside it which is not objectively aware at all. And if we go on cutting this being and stimulating it with pain, just like the amoeba contracts under the pain stimulus given all around it, so each one of these subsidiary entities will contract inside the being, and that will leave around each of these subsidiary entities a large field of activity not characterized in itself. In other words, we'll be increasing the amount of free space inside the being as a whole. Now, instead of talking from the materialistic standpoint, we'll talk about the psyche itself. We know that the protoplasm depends upon the psyche for its sensitivity. The protoplasm is only so much matter, but this matter depends on the psyche, the feeling, sentient power that holds that matter together. If we now talk about the psyche itself, we see that the psyche can identify with any number of idea complexes. But if these idea complexes within the psyche are made very, very painful, the psyche contracts on them and tries to drive them down to infinitesimally small points. Supposing for a moment it succeeds, so that we have a psyche with very tiny little points of form contracted within it, then we also have a psyche with a large amount of free space in it. And this free space is that which is not finited by the complex ideas that are painful, and because of the continuity of the substance underlying the psyche, here represented by the white paper, therefore this psyche is becoming aware of motions originating from any point in space, whatever. So that the individuated psyche there, driven by schizophrenia into compressing its formal content through pain, becomes progressively more and more like a pure psyche, like a psyche with no content of its own. And at this point, any other entity round about it, broadcasting individually, will send its characteristic motion into the psyche of the schizophrene, and as his own mental content has become hammered down because of its painful nature, he will become progressively more and more unconscious of his own individuation complexes and more and more prone to receiving other individuated elements from outside. And this accounts for the telepathic phenomena that we find, which we've just found to be the basis of this question. This was also found in hypnotic subjects, hysterical subjects, in the most famous of the French hypnotic schools, where patients who were continuously hypnotized and thereby de-individuated found that they were able to tell where the doctor was when he was away, and they could recite that he was with Mrs. So-and-so and did such and such, and this caused the doctor to think very, very carefully about whether he should hypnotize anybody so often that they didn't know where he was. Now we see here in this schizophrenia the kind of thing that we are looking for when we are practicing yoga, namely the disintegration of the individuated complexes with which one normally identifies and which keep one in a state of individuation. If we want to gain absolute consciousness, we have to transcend individuation. And the funny thing about the schizophrene generally is that he's intelligent. That is to say, he has a large number of ideas inside himself, fairly sharply defined and therefore disparate, and this gives him a kind of brilliance. Imagine we take a pure piece of protoplasm with no knowledge at all. Suppose when we give it a stimulus, and that stimulus is the knowledge of mathematics. So we insert into it a large zone of mathematical knowledge. Suppose we now give him another education, and this one gives him a large zone of knowledge of religion. And we give him another stimulus, and this gives him a large zone of activity of art, and another zone of science. Now, unless he gets an integrating concept to tie together his science, his art, his religion, and so on, these things will react independently as if they were entities in their own right. They're subsidiary entities. In a real sense, they're as valid as any individual is in the universe. That is to say, insofar as they function separately, they must be considered as practical individuals. They are subsidiary entities acting with their own awareness and therefore are subsidiary personalities. Now, if we again stimulate inside any one of these complexes, we can subdivide it again, cutting the religions up into primitive religions, modern religions, and so on. Every time we cut into a given complex, we analyze it, and in the analysis we create space, because analysis means we are loosing the motion. This ana thing means a runner, actually, and the root nous means loose. So this analysis means that these running motions are going to be loose from each other. If we get an idea and analyze it and separate the parts, we then have space between the separated parts. Now this space is the ground of our clairvoyance and the ground of our telepathy and the ground of magic and so on. This is the interspace in the exercise we have discussed before. In the case of an advanced schizophrenia, there's a tremendous amount of space with a lot of very painful, sharply contracted ideas within it. Through the sharply contracted ideas, he is reactive in an individual way and is considered to be insane, which means unwhole, unintegrated. But in relation to the space that he has discovered within himself, he is literally superconscious. Now, if he knew that he was superconscious and shifted the accent of his consciousness and will into the space between, then the schizophrenic elements in him, the unintegrated idea complexes, would begin to find their own places by resonance. And then he would go through what is called a spontaneous cure, which sometimes happens in schizophrenia. The important thing here is that he is going accidentally through the same kind of thing that one goes through deliberately in cultivating by means of sense withdrawal, concentration, meditation, contemplation, the same thing that the yogi is pursuing, namely the free space which constitutes his absolute essential being and the ground of his freedom. One schizophrenic, talking about his own processes, said, "I think there are two kinds of people in the world. In fact, I feel uncomfortable about calling it two kinds of people. I don't like the word people, and I'm going to reject it and say there are two kinds of beings walking about on two legs, and one of them I call things, and the other I call operators. And the thing is one that is pushed about by an operator, and an operator is a being that can push a thing about." And he felt very, very strongly that here was a case in his own experience where sometimes he felt impelled to do something by something other than himself. And he heard a compulsive voice saying, "Do so and so and so and so." And he knew that it was not that complex of ideas to which he referred when he said, "I," and that it was terribly strong and could overthrow him periodically, and that in relation to it he was a thing. And thinking about it within his brilliant split mind and identifying with the space within, he decided there was a supreme operator which, said he, is no doubt God, And there are many things about the place, things within space, which believe they are individuals, but they're really only things. So he divides the universe up into free will consciousness, called operator, and non-free will, non-consciousness, which he calls thing. And he insists that bipeds that cannot determine their own behavior are not operators, but things. What he has discovered is that if you become aware of the space inside yourself, you can break identification with any given idea complex. And in the act of breaking identification with it, you become free. But in that free state, you might say something which, because you have been defined as mentally ill, savors of the transcendent, or, as they say technically, you are paranoic about it. You come beyond the limits of mind as it is known, and therefore you are paranoia. You come beyond that intelligence that they know about, therefore you must be crazy. Now, it's precisely within this transcendence that the real wisdom of the sick person appears. Gradually, he begins to work out his problem. Possibly, if he were not interfered with at all and were put on a desert island and left to his own devices, given time, the resonances of his own complexes inside would arrange themselves and he would return to health in splendid isolation. We know of cases in which this has happened spontaneously. We know of one or two cases where a being that has been isolated because of this kind of disorder has been found to be recovered when re-examined. Deprived of the external stimuli, the internal has sorted itself out into its own peculiar hierarchical order. So, surely we can say this, that if you take any finite being and analyze it, in the act of making the cut and pushing the things apart, you are increasing space within it. So, as you cut with your knife through and through, the thing is becoming less and less opaque. If you cut an apple with a knife, and keep on cutting it and cutting it, you'll finish up with mush. You're destroying the hardness of it. If you cut it further still, you'll cut into the atomic level. If you cut deeper still, you'll cut into the energy quanta, and they'll suddenly disperse as motions of the field. This is the kind of process that is going on in the schizophrenia, but which, carried to its ultimate term, would result in absolute consciousness. We find that the people who have had the greatest experiences of cosmic consciousness have frequently been defined by psychologists as psychopaths or as schizophrenes, certainly are suffering from some kind of mental disorder. I have a folder from Allen and Hanbury's, the drug manufacturers, in which it says that William Blake, prophet, poet, mystic, writer, artist, and so on, saw visions and painted them. He gives a wonderful description of all Blake's work, and then it says at the end, you can avoid all this by taking our product and so on. Now, she said quite seriously, Allen and Hanbury's have produced it. They are saying that any person, whatever, who transcends ordinary consciousness requires drug attention.
This would suggest, though, that the schizophrene would require someone with the vocabulary to be able to clarify this for him if he doesn't have it himself, wouldn't he?
Well, it would help if he had, it would be a short.
Otherwise, he wouldn't be a schizophrene. If you have a sufficiently extended vocabulary to be able to handle all the pieces.
Yes, he wants the link factors in the vocabulary. Mm.
So even if he sees, as your agent did, this concept of an operator and a thing, although he's come to the terms operator and thing, there may be a confusion arising there if he begins to identify with the thing himself. Conceiving this as operating instead of thing.
Yeah.
So it would require, he still requires this external help, or this external vocabulary to enable him to link that a lot together.
Yes. The vocabulary, of course, would tend to arise spontaneously within himself in time,
yeah,
if he were not acted upon from outside by defining beings with systems of psychology,
yeah,
to categorize him.
Like the deaf boy with his hieroglyphics.
Yeah. Is that sufficiently clear about that?
Yes. Incidentally, the book I'm speaking of is called Operators and Things.
Is it really?
Yes.
I wonder where that came from.
That's Barbara Robbie wrote it.
It's a kind of concept that I've found in a lot of mental patients, that they are telepathic, that there's a kind of jargon going about amongst them, that many of them understand each other and can help each other, and some of them have a very dim opinion of the men in charge, who are busy disbelieving some of their experiences, which they believe are quite valid. And this does not mean that some people are not bonkers. There'll be another one. Not human.
Using logical terms of reference, Gene, can one find within one word a subject and a predicate?
Yeah. As soon as you define a word, you've necessarily found a subject and a predicate. And if you don't define the word, it isn't a word for you. It's just the occasion of a reaction. If we remember the word itself means a power ordering, then straight away we have already a subject and a predicate. Now, if we don't know that this is the meaning of word, we don't have any power to act. We are passive. The word hits us and produces a change in us, entirely by its own peculiar resonances and association links. But that would mean that you would be a thing and not an operator. So, obviously, as the essential character of the human being consists in certain qualities, certain awarenesses, one of which is manipulation of the words, and the words require to be defined in order to be manipulated accurately, then a real understanding of word can't be gone into too seriously or too deeply. There's a dreadful tendency not to bother about the words, not to think about the words, not to use a dictionary, not to find out the etymology, and so on. But insofar as one doesn't, one is missing the key to freedom. When it says that Jesus is the most excellent name, it is making a statement that comes straight out of a secret tradition to do with reflexive self-consciousness and the possibility of freedom. It isn't just a figure of speech to say his name is the most excellent name, because his name actually signifies saying yes to no. The first part of his name means yes, and the last part means no. You can see this most obviously in the Hebrew, where the final terminal letter, the ayin, means no, means refusal. And the first part means affirmation. So you affirm the negation. Now that is the most excellent name. Now a name, as we've seen before, this noun root, is the reverse of man. Man means to evaluate, the basis mark to measure, and the motion, the continuance of the measurement. Man is a continually measuring being. He measures by means of naming. He can't measure unless he makes himself a foot pound second. He must have some kind of system, a length measurement, a weight measurement, and a time measurement, otherwise he can't measure. So he must name the entities in his consciousness in order to apply them. And if he does name them and then applies them, then he is a man. Coming along in the car today as we're going to a certain Inquisitionist who survived from Spain long ago, we talked about the mineral world, and then the plant world, and then the animal world, this is an animal, and then the man world, and then the human world, which is another man up here with the halo on. And then the divine world above that. Now, The word in the New Testament translated right is a word which simply means being. It comes from a root meaning being. So that a being is right when it is being itself. This is a rule against adultery. If you add something to yourself which spoils you reaching your ultimate, you are adulterated. And thereby you are less being yourself than you were, and therefore less right. A being is right when it is being itself. So we say the right of a stone is to lie around the place. That's its right, simply to be existent. And the right of a vegetable is to grow out of that stone, to spread itself out, to change its form by absorbing from within and pushing out. The right of an animal is to run about. The right of a man is to evaluate. The right of a human is to become aware of his power and reflexively conscious. And the right of a divine being is to become cosmically aware. Those are the orders. There are different levels of being. If we haven't got a term, we cannot climb out of the conceptual group that is already imposed upon us. Factually, we come into the world as eggs, and these eggs are potentially anything. And if they didn't get a superstress on them from an external stimulus of some order, they would simply remain potentially anything, and particularly nothing. They would be all wise ignorance if it were not for the external stimulus coming to them. And the initial stimulus coming to them characterizes them in such a way that all subsequent stimuli are modified by the first one. Supposing we say here is an egg, and it is a rule in yoga that the person knows what a thing is by changing the shape of his psyche so that he feels what that being is. Supposing we give this spherical being a stimulus, and the stimulus we give it is a pyramid. So it assumes the shape of a pyramid. Now it's lost the shape of the sphere by taking the superstress pyramid. Supposing that is its first experience, strong pyramid stimulus, it becomes a pyramid. The next one hits it while it's in the state pyramid, and perhaps this one is a square. Now this square one fights the pyramid, but the pyramid fights back. And the result is a hybrid form. The pyramid is distorted by the square in some way. If we now fire a crescent shape at it, this will distort it further. But the initial superstressing stimulus is going to condition all subsequent stimuli. Now the strange thing is this, that apart from language, the law of association in the mind would not be very damaging. Supposing we take an example, supposing there is a primitive man and there is an earthquake, and he sees the earth open up and his mother-in-law disappears down the crevice there formed, and he bursts into tears and has a mental photograph of what happens when the earth opens up. Now that is a particular thing, but supposing he has no word for it, all he actually sees is disappearance of loved one down a crack in the earth, and that's all he can react to. So unless there is another crack in the earth at another time, he cannot be frightened by the memory of the first time. So that if there were no words whatever, we could only be frightened by identical situations with the original one that frightened us. If there were no words at all, physical pain stimuli would be needed to educate us. Emotional states are the products of physical pain stimuli, using physical, not merely as gross matter, because the root of the word physical comes from a word meaning to grow, the Greek equivalent of the Latin nature. And we would find that we couldn't get into much trouble because we would require a physical stimulus of the same order as the first one to reduce us to a state of fear. But as soon as we introduce vocabulary, we've done a very peculiar thing. We have allowed ourselves to associate together elements that have no necessary connection. No external objective fact, as if we take the concept of a centaur or a satyr or any mythical animal, we are talking about something that never existed in the external physical world and which nevertheless can occupy the mind of a schizophrene with very great vigour. As soon as we compound two words together, we fuse together the referential values of those terms in our mind. So to an effect, we take an egg, which is irritable or reactive. We shout the letter A in the ear of the sentient sphere, and at the same time we apply a hot poker to it. Now, because it hears the A and feels the pain simultaneously, then the presentation of the sound A will conjure up the sensation of being burnt, and yet it has nothing to do with it. This is the principle we call conditioning one's reflexes. And a man, generally speaking, is a bundle of conditioned reflexes. If we fire many stimuli together into a being, and one of them is painful, the painful one will always be re-stimulated when any one of the other elements is represented. This is the ground of a propaganda of a lot of religion, of a lot of state orders, and so on. First you get hit and something is shouted to you. Subsequently, when it is shouted, you feel you are being hit and you obey to avoid this physical damage. Later, because of physical damage, you can be made to go into an emotional state, and the word repeated when you're in an emotional state, perhaps the words, "I told you so," that always happens to bad boys. With such a formula, you can re-stimulate the memories of pains and create emotional conflicts. Now, without words, we can't do this. With words, we can. So that insofar as a man has not got all his vocabulary accurately defined, he is passive to the effects of that vocabulary upon his being. When Spinoza said that adequate knowledge equals activity and inadequate knowledge equals passivity, he meant it. And adequate knowledge is verbalized knowledge with all the elements of it adequately defined. And if we don't define them adequately, then we are inadequate in our definition and our response is deficient. Let's consider again the virtue of the stone. Its rightness is to lie about the place. The virtue of the plant is to break down this stone and assimilate it and grow. The plant feels, and it feels that it must grow outwards and carry with it the matter upon which it stands and in which it is rooted. The animal not only feels, it desires. It has pleasures and pains. It responds to stimuli by running towards them if they're nice and away from them if they're not nice. A man is simply the same thing as the mineral, the vegetable and the animal, plus the ability to count. But the ability to count is entirely mechanical. He is still a slave. The stone is a slave to inertia. The plant is enslaved by the force of inertia from the earth and by feeling. The animal is enslaved by the force of inertia from the earth, by the feeling of the plant, and by its desire nature it likes and dislikes. And it runs about, getting what it wants and avoiding what it doesn't want. And the man is enslaved by the mechanical processes in him called counting. Now, a human is supposed to break out of this slavery. He must not only evaluate, he must gain control of his own will. He's a hetman, he's a power man. He must get hold of what H signifies, and he must transcend a merely mechanical counting process and turn the power of his own will back upon himself so that he can, in effect, inhibit the responses of the stone, of the vegetable, of the animal, and the man. He must be able to drive himself in a way that an animal can't. He must be able to drive himself towards a painful thing, away from a pleasant thing.
Gene,
yes?
In this in the transitional stage from man to human,
Yeah.
Is adultery being committed? Or what is right by definition for the person in that transitional state?
This again depends entirely on the correct use of terms. Every term has a significance. If we take the term man, and this is where Aristotelian logic will not help us very much in dealing with the concrete situation, the term man is to be applied to a being that can count, evaluate, and continues to count and evaluate. Now, as soon as we talk about human, we're talking about a being that has transcended the mere counting and has become aware of himself as a power. He is able to interfere with this process of counting by act of will. He can stop it, he can start it. And at the precise moment where he's gained a tiny bit of reflexive awareness of his own power, he's gained a tiny bit of humanity. And at such moment, the title human is permissible for the moment. But he will not be a fully realized human until he can do it all the time. Now, is it adultery? If we are adding water to the milk and pretending we are selling milk, that is adultery. But if we want a drink of water, clean, and somebody gives us a glass that's got somebody else's leftover milk at the bottom, then the clean water has been adulterated by the milk. So the question of what is adultery depends on what we are willing to have. And anything other than what we will is adultery. So if a human wills to be man at a given moment, it would be adultery for him to distort the counting process by arbitrary act of will. So when he's willing to be man, he will accept that triangles have three sides. But if he wanted to transcend that and be human, he would have to say, for arbitrary purpose of his will, the triangles do not have three sides. That he can, in fact, make a spherical triangle, which has curvature of each side so great that the three of them constitute a circle, which is no triangle. This is quite a simple method. Sounds queer. We draw a straight line triangle. And suppose we draw this thing on a globe, the sides are curved. And everybody would agree that that's a triangle with curved sides. But if we start pushing the curvature out, at a certain point, the three curves make a perfect circle. And that perfect circle is indeed a curved triangle. At this point, we've come to a transitional point where either of two definitions will do. In the same way, we can talk about a line being curved, less curved, less curved, less curved, less curved, to infinity, and then say that the infinitely small curvature of a line signifies that line as infinite curvature, that is a straight line. In that case, a straight line is a curve, providing the curvature is infinitely small. Now, when we're doing this consciously, we are not committing adultery. We are actually juggling with limiting factors in terminology. If we know what we are doing, it is not adultery. If we know what our aim is, it is not adultery. But if we don't know, and we're trying to get A, and we keep getting bits of B in it, then it is adultery. So from the point of view of the absolute, prior to the objectification with the only begotten Son or Cosmic Lord, prior to then, he was purely himself, utterly unadulterated. He then willed an objective world. Now that objective world was the first spot in Spotty Mary. And prior to this objective world, this absolute infinite ocean was spotless. It was unadulteratedly, absolutely a continuum with no finite in functions. As soon as it makes this objective sphere within itself, if the thing was against its will, then it was adultery. But if it was a will to objectification, then it was not. And it's very important to realize, again, the meaning of the word important. Important means in carrying. That is important which we will. Now it is obvious here we have a method of avoiding adultery by willing absolutely everything whatever. Supposing we will, prodigal-like, to know all about everything. And we don't want there to be anything left undone. As Nietzsche says, the steps we do not tread upon will never forgive us. And we don't want to be not forgiven, so we're going to tread on all the steps. Now, if it is our intention to finish up with total knowledge, then whatever we do is not adultery. Whereas, if it was our intention to retain concept X, which excludes non-X, and in fact non-X kept getting into our X, then it would be adultery. So we decide that a being, which has no name unless we will it to have one, shall be called man as to its function when it is counting on purpose, shall be called human when it is willing power rather than counting. When the counting becomes a means to the expression of a will, we can call it human. But if it is merely a counting process that is counting for counting and not simply as an expression of will, then it is only man. And any given being, which is primarily in its original sphere, can simultaneously do all these things at once. Now, if he's doing them all at once accidentally, he is committing adultery. But if he does all at once deliberately, then it is not adultery. So whether we adulterate or not depends entirely on our intent. So the prodigal son, who sets out to know all about everything, is no adulterer when he arrives back with a perfectly equilibrated sphere of knowledge. And his brother, who didn't go out, is also unadulterated. But the qualities of the two different kinds of non-adulteration are totally different. The one that never went out is unadulterated himself. The one that did go out is unadulteratedly himself, plus all his experiences. Now, if he'd have gone out in the first place, got kicked by a lonely pig, didn't like the pain on his ankle bone and turned back immediately and went home crying, he would have said, I have been adulterated by the kick of that mad pig. But if it's his intention to go down, learn all about it and come back, it is no adultery. We observe that in fact, while we are talking in this manner, that what we are actually doing is evoking mental content by manipulating letters of the alphabet. The words that we use are only letters of the alphabet, they are nothing else. And yet, through thousands of years, they have acquired a tremendous charge upon them, an aura and an association power so great that a modern man cannot, in fact, shake himself free from the weight of tradition in terms, the weight of tradition locked in words, locked in letters. So that a man with his own name, maybe not very important, and a man with his own name, plus one or two letters of the alphabet, lo, one shall bend the knee to him. The power of these letters is so great that it can force bending of the knee, and does so. Society is built up on it. It's built up on slavery to not understood sounds, symbols. Therefore, if we are to attain the freedom we want, we must get hold of this vocabulary. And we must fight the inertia in ourselves that doesn't want to get hold of it. Just like there are operators and things, so there is inertia and free energy. Inertia means that the work, the et, is being affirmed simply in being. The stone doesn't stop being a stone, it just goes on. All its particles, all the energy quanta in it, are busy running round and round and round, localizing themselves, simply existing without any change. This existing without any change we call inertia, in working. Now the change from inertia to exertia requires the appearance of consciousness and the willing of what one is doing, the becoming aware that one is willing it, because becoming aware is an essential precondition to changing what is going on. so that we cannot change an inertia in our body unless we first recognize it as an inertia and as a will working at some point. So we can say that there is no inertia whatever other than the motion of previously established will. So if there is an inertia in us, we have at some time past willed it, and we have imposed upon ourselves this limiting inertia. I am mine own executioner, said a mystic. I am mine own executioner means I have willed myself into this condition, and all my inertias are simply the corroboration of my previous willings. Now, if we become conscious of this fact, we have been using words to make ourselves conscious of it, because in fact there are no animals that can make themselves conscious without a vocabulary. And a human being is a human being because he has a vocabulary with the term hue added to the term man. If he were not human and just man, he'd be reacting to what is symbolized by the M and the A and the N. And he'd be automatically counting things. We can make mechanical counters that can tell you how many packets of cornflakes have come down the chute today. They tick over and recite and push a dial about and give you a reading of so many thousands per day of packets. They don't know what they're doing. Now, man walking about in the street is likewise ticking over and registering, and there is coming out of his mouth a number corresponding with the kind of end result of the process inside him, but he is entirely mechanical. That is to say, he is not reflexively capable of interfering with the process. Now, to become aware of this process is step one. The Indian yoga method of becoming aware is simply sit down and watch the monkey jump. The mind is the monkey and it jumps about. If you don't know how stupid it is, you won't try to stop it. But if you watch it and don't interfere with it, you will become convinced that it is a fool. And when you are absolutely convinced how stupid the mind is in its reaction, then you will start wanting to do something about it. And if you listen very carefully to the stuff that goes through your head, the utter illogicality of it, the fantasy, the narcissistic self-witness that occurs in it, the frequent repetition of I and my in it, and you discover how utterly mechanical and stupid it is, then you can say, I, change the meaning of the letter, means something other than this complex of nonsense. I now becomes pure consciousness. You use the letter I to signify pure consciousness, and when you say I, you think of an I that is an observing being. And you use a drawing of the I to symbolize it. So that when you say I, then, you simply mean consciousness in this place. You do not then say I equals a given recognizable form that other beings have named. And when you say I equals consciousness in this way, you transcend the limitations of your name. You can even change your name if you wanted to. But you couldn't even begin to want to unless you thought that that name had significance. Unless you thought it was impeding you. I knew a woman on one occasion who refused to marry a man called Tart unless he agreed to change it to Tate. And he agreed. The girl was nice and she was worth becoming Tate for Tart. And then it became Tit for Tat. The point is, there is a very deep feeling in the human race about names. Children feel this very, very strongly about nicknames. A nickname is an eek name, a name that one eats out. If your name is too long, we give you a short one. One that's more economic, one that takes less time. But the nickname you get very often has something to do with your behavior when you're a kiddie. And by means of nicknames, little children can be tortured. And by means of names, governments force people into categories. And if they can persuade them to identify with the category, then they can say, march forward, category A, once more into the breach, dear friends, farewell. Your post-war benefits will be given to your grandchildren. Now, as soon as you can characterize, categorize, and force identification of any beings, you have in effect reduced them to machines, and you can drive them about by studying the law of that machine. The new science called cybernetics, which is sweeping the world, is based on a concept called the human use of human beings. And it's a very amusing concept because it says mechanization is going on, automation is going on so rapidly that very soon there won't be any jobs for men to do at all. This might be a myth because they keep breaking down all the time. Sometimes it requires so many men to maintain the machine that displaced them that they're all back at work again. But let's assume for a moment that all the machines are so efficient that they lay baby machines to replace themselves when they wear out. This is actually seriously being considered now, and a machine has been designed that can assemble its baby. All you have to do is feed it the raw material. And there is a machine being designed now to go and dig the raw material out. This will produce a long line of machines, different baby machines, to do the work. Now the problem is immediately raised. When we've got all this machinery doing all this work, what is the proper use of human beings? Now observe the colossal cheek in a group of people saying, what is the proper use of human beings? And where there's a use, there's a user. Now it's all based on the concept of feedback. What they're saying is this: the government, who are using these machines to displace labour, because labour is a bit arbitrary and tends to want more than it deserves. If we can displace labour and put machines in its place, then we have this strange problem: what shall we do with the displaced human beings? Notice, what shall we, the government, do with these beings who have been displaced? They're not quite as snarky as they ought to be. We can't keep them in order. So what shall we do to absorb their energies, which might overthrow us and just move into our beds wearing sheets, like those cunning pigs in 1984, and take over the whole government, including the machines that make the babies to replace themselves? Now the only way you can find out what to do with these human beings, if you are such a government, is to study the nature of reaction and then devise some kind of concept which can be imposed upon these beings in such a way that they will in fact accept it and thus become categorized and remain non-revolutionary elements walking about and enjoying themselves quietly without overthrowing the government. Serious intentions have been expressed by Malthusians and others that the best thing to do as soon as we've got all the machines is to have a terrific war and eliminate billions of people so that there won't be enough of them to overthrow us, but just sufficient to tend the machines. This is a utopia. It is a very serious idea. Really serious attempts will be made to cause it to come into being. A lot of money is being spent to that end. If they succeed, it will prove that we're all snarks and not boojums. But we know a very peculiar thing: to every action there's an equal and opposite reaction. So as they are studying to solve this cybernetic problem of the human use of human beings, some of the human beings are busy already sowing the seeds of revolution, sowing the seeds of reflexive self-consciousness, so that it would become extremely difficult to use those human beings at all. They will become such that nobody can use them, they will use themselves. But all of this depends on vocabulary. Without an adequate vocabulary, you cannot train yourself. Without an adequate system of symbols, you cannot manipulate your own reactions. And so, symbology is the key to the whole thing. So hand in hand with cybernetics is the relatively new science of semiotics and semantics. Somehow the significance of words is intimately linked with this question of the human use of human beings. The only reason they don't say the inhuman use of human beings is because they want to publish the book without anybody reading it. the British Museum want to cover for their file. The terribly important thing is that we must use vocabulary to do it. Let's take a very old example of vocabulary. A division of the human race into operators and things, or goats and sheep. It's exactly the same concept. There are beings who are sheep, and there are beings who are goats. And the funny thing about the goats is this. They have a go at things, and they tend to stimulate sheep to want to be goats. Now this is a bit awful on the sheep, because if they start wanting to be goats and they're not goats, they will start skipping about on the mountain tops and skid. Now the peculiar thing about the goat, he doesn't need anybody to tell him to do something. He just has a go. But it is possible to hypnotize a goat to make it think it's a sheep. It's quite a simple thing. I've hypnotized a goat myself. I made it join a flock of sheep. Now, when this happens, the being that would otherwise have been free has been bound by a concept because he was off guard. He was a young goat. I don't mean in years, he wasn't. But in fact, he was a goat who was unaware fully of his own potential. And he had imposed upon him a concept that he was a sheep. Thereupon he joined the flock. Now, I'm talking about real goats and sheep at the moment, not humans. This is not a metaphor. Suppose we make it into a metaphor and say there are some human beings who are not sure whether they are sheep or goats. And they think to themselves, I want to become a goat. And I feel that I need to be taught how to be a goat, and therefore I must go to a goat to remind me how to be a goat. Now, if he really needs to be reminded how to be a goat, he's either a sheep thinking he's a goat when he's not, or he's a partially hypnotized goat who wants to be hypnotized. And this is the kind of thing that goes on. To graduate from thing to operator or sheep to goat is impossible. If you remember the old tag, the body can never be saved, the self was never lost. What then is salvation? The answer is realization of the fact there is something that cannot be saved and something that was never lost. And that which was never lost was pure consciousness, and that which never can be saved is the object. So the best thing to do is stop identification with the object. Now the only difference between a sheep and a goat is this, that the sheep is identified with the flock and the goat is not. And there's nothing but identification differentiating man into sheep and goats. So that if you can break identification with any given concept, you automatically become a goat in relation to that. If you break identification with all concepts, whatever, including that of matter, cosmos, you become an absolute goat. And you behave in an absolute goat manner if you're not careful, and yet not tempted. The important thing to realize is that nothing but pure consciousness, reflexively self-aware, can be a goat adequately. But this very same goat is mysteriously a sheep. Because it leads itself and follows itself, and it knows that there is nothing other than it pushing it and nothing other than it following it. This is higher than a monistic concept that would say it's either a big sheep or a big goat. It is non-dual. As to its substantial aspect occupying infinite space, it is mass inertia, a sheep. As to its initiative force, it is the free chooser, the catalyst, the eye that causes change, but this is the goat. So in the mysterious Goetia of the Naughty Magicians we find the simple doctrine that that which is absolutely is a sheep goat, and we find that this duality is expressed in Christ, who is the scapegoat and the sacrificial lamb. As scapegoat, he understands that there is nothing other than the absolute power and with this he is identified. But he understands that this very, very same power, being all in all, there can be nothing other than it. And as to its spatial occupancy, it is a mass power, and as such a mass inertia. It is inworking. But as to its absolute self-consciousness and initiative, it is free. But it has to assume the responsibility for what it does with itself. It leads itself. The absolute leads itself into objectivity and makes a universe. But the objective world cannot move unless the field moves it. So the external objective world is a sheep. But it doesn't look like a sheep, it looks like a goat. Whereas the invisible field that nobody can feel at all, which it undoubtedly feels as harmless as a lamb, is in actual fact the goat that is pushing everything about. If we can understand this polarity, we can get hold of our own being. Discussing this the other night with some very qualified people, there was an agreement at the end, but only by the women who were there. All the men disliked it and complained and said they'd have to think about it. The statement was made that absolute power, considered as power, was female. Considered as formal behavior, it was male. But the formal behavior was only an effect of the power, and therefore, in a peculiar sense, men are inferior to women. Because the ideas are generated by the field, and the field initiates the condensation we call an idea. And you get this very clearly expressed in a woolly way, called mystical, in Indian philosophy, where the female power of God, the Shakti, is the all-in-all in terms of power, whereas God himself, as a male, is utterly powerless. He's only the idea that she pushes around. But we should suspect this because it's a patriarchal doctrine. When we talk about the irrational will, we're talking about power, abstractly considered apart from its form. When we consider the drive, in its formless aspect, we're talking about femaleness, tremendous will, want, without definition. But it is an abstract concept of a power which is formless, and it is female. When we consider the idea purely as form without power, then it is male. Now, in fact, there are no ideas that are not powers, and there are no powers that are not form. So that all existential beings are male-female. But nevertheless, there is a stress on any given being more on the initiative will than on the form, or more on the form than on the will. And the funny thing is that this polarity is inverted in such a way that in any given being, if the being looks like a woman on the outside, it is a man on the inside. And as the inside is more important than the outside, it follows that it is really a man wherever you see a woman's body. But wherever you see a man's body, it is a woman. There's a woman on the inside of a man, and a man on the inside of a woman. Now, if this is fully known, then a man, instead of trying to conform externally to the behavior called man, should realize that he is a woman, and say essentially an arbitrary, irrational will. And a woman should realize that because she's so damned willful on the outside and utterly irrational, that she should become what she really is, a perfectly logical creature like she is on the inside. Now, all the women agreed with this. They're very intelligent women, and they said, we are very logical, and funnily enough, we are very faithful. We are utterly trustworthy because we know what we want, and we never let go of it. We know what we want, we never let go of it, and therefore we are ever faithful, ever true, to our purpose. And all else on the outside is a matter of expediency caused by the stupidity of men. At this point I thought, as there was such a great consensus of opinion, I would quote Francis Thompson's words, their treacherous trueness and their loyal deceit. They know what they want. They know exactly what they want. They want to be central to the universe and to allow infinite power to come through them and to press through them in the form of progeny for millions and millions of space-time units, in fact forever. And to that they are faithful. But a man doesn't know that they want this, and he thinks he wants something else, what he calls truth. And to this he is dedicated in his male sign. So he's dedicated to mathematics and geometry. So he's dealing in a peculiar sense with the abstract side of reality, the intellectual side, and she is dealing with the biological side. But if he doesn't know this fact, he expects her to conform to his abstract geometrical, mathematical and logical principles. Whereas she is very busy on the inside conforming to her divinely appointed biological end. Now, by means of terms, we can sort out this polarity within the human being. The skeleton of a human being is a hermaphrodite or an androgyne, or find a difference between a hermaphrodite and an androgyne. As the doctor said to me the other night, when you are talking about your bipolar being, it is terribly important that you tell us that it is a hermaphrodite or an androgyne. Apparently there was a very great difference. There is, actually. It's worth looking at to find out what. The terms are not synonymous, although they're approximately so. We have said there are no absolute synonyms. So where two words appear to mean the same thing, there must be a difference. And this is one of the chief methods in propaganda of diverting you. They give you a term which is equivalent to another term, and you swallow it because it's equivalent, only it isn't. A little boy was arguing with his mother, who is a doctor, the other day, and he said, why have all those people protesting against the bomb being arrested? And the mother said, because they have broken the law, dear. And he said, who makes the law, mummy? And she says, the people make the law, dear, this is a democracy. And he said, are those who have been arrested people? And she said, yes. And he said, were they arrested because they were trying to change the law? And she said, I suppose so. He said, well then, it isn't a democracy. Now she felt awful, because this little boy is quite tiny. But like all little boys or little girls in that age, their logic is not yet spoiled. He was a penetrating criticism. The mother's inertia said, it is a democracy. And she said to me, can you tell me how I can convince him that it is a democracy? And I said, no, I can't convince myself. Now, if we can get hold of our terms, and we go back to a very early rule, if we can get the same objective reference and use the same terms, we cannot misunderstand each other. And if we don't misunderstand each other, our will operate freely. Which means we will all be self-determined. And nobody can push us around. And we shall be like it is said, in those days no man shall teach another of God, but all shall know him. But in that event there will be no subjects of one being to another, nor subjects of masses to an individual, and no building of external pyramids by slavery or anything else. But that time is not yet arrived. So meanwhile, some beings who know the ropes, and rope is rupa, which means form, and rupa nama, nama rupa, are not to be separated. Those who know the name forms are in fact duping the rest by the misuse of vocabulary. So we cannot too strongly stress the need for a continuous return to the dictionary. This brings us now to being too late to deal with the letter.